I'm Rick Dedarian, and this is Realms of Memory. When I spoke with Joel Waldman about the book he wrote about his mom, Carmela, a child Holocaust survivor, he repeatedly drew parallels with the film Life is Beautiful. In the 1999 Oscar award-winning film, actor-director Roberto Benigni plays a Jewish father who will do anything to hide the true horrors of the Holocaust from his son. Like Benigni's character, Carmela, whom Joel affectionately calls Carm, chooses to hide much of her past to protect her family. The book, Surviving the Survivor, which has the same name as Joel's hit true crimes podcast, which Carm sometimes co-hosts, is an effort to unpack a number of difficult memories from Carm's life. Like the film, Joel's book is filled with warmth, humor, and love. It addresses a wide range of topics from marriage to money that go far beyond the Holocaust. But throughout, it raises important questions about why we sometimes choose to bury difficult memories and whether this is ever truly possible. A conversation with Joel Waldman about his book and podcast, Surviving the Survivor, in this episode of Realms of Memory.
So my name is Joel Waldman. I'm a former network news correspondent. Most recently, I was with Fox News out of Washington, D.C., covering politics. I started on the complete other end of the political spectrum before news outlets were political, and that was as a producer for MSNBC, one of the first hires, and then in the middle there from working at MSNBC in the mid-90s, I kind of fell into reporting. Ended up on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange covering U.S. equities, and then did sort of a local reporting route through West Palm Beach, Miami, through Arizona, then ultimately back to my home area, which is a tri-state area, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut. And I was an investigative reporter at Fox 5 in New York City. And from there was sort of called up to the big leagues, if you will, by Roger Ailes, then the CEO of Fox News, who brought me to Fox News Channel. And I was covering politics on a day-to-day basis, but was also part of a breaking news team. And then decided to leave sort of traditional corporate media, launched a company, the pandemic hit, everything screeched to a halt. And then I had this crazy idea of starting a podcast with my then, I guess, 82-year-old mother, who is now coming up on 86, and she is sort of the host emerita, and I do a live daily roundtable show in the true crime space. I'm sort of, I describe myself as the Larry King of true crime. I think it's the only live nightly talk show about trending criminal cases in America.
Joel, welcome to Realms of Memory.
Thank you for having me. I know we had a little bit of a tough time coordinating it. I apologize for that, but I am here and excited to talk to you.
So we'll be talking about the book that you wrote about your mom, the same name as the podcast, Surviving the Survivor, but with an important different ending, a brutally honest conversation about life and death with my mom, a Holocaust survivor, therapist, and my podcast co-host. And it was brutally honest. I mean, you really, you have a very unique relationship with your mom where you're tackling lots of sensitive topics and really not holding back on anything. But throughout your book, I think one of the themes that carried across the whole book is you trying to understand this unique perspective your mom has. She's a very optimistic, positive person. Yet she's gone through a lot of personal tragedies as a child, as a young mother, and recently, in recent years. So she's experienced a lot of personal tragedies. And as you sat down and you spent hours interviewing her with your telephone recorder, you're trying to figure out, you know, how did she come to terms with all of this? How did she survive all of this and maintain a positive outlook? And so I think if we could start just with the first survival story, the Holocaust one, could you recap what she went through and how she made it through?
Yeah, well, her story, I think by all accounts, is a really interesting one and one that needs to be told. And obviously, I was a journalist by profession and continue to be now an independent journalist covering true crime. So I thought, you know, it was incumbent upon me to share her story. Now, did I think I'd ever actually do it? Not really, if I'm being honest. This, I tell everybody, was sort of an outer body experience for me, and we can get into the writing process, but it is still weird for me to see my book cover and say, hey, I wrote that. As far as my mom's story, she was born in what is the former Yugoslavia, now Serbia. And it was 1939 was the year she was born. Her father was a very well-educated optometrist and optician. He had gone to one of the better schools in Germany, spoke fluent German. And in the book, I actually have his degree in optometry. And my grandmother was sort of, you know, I guess a typical homemaker back in the day. But she also was an educator. She taught for a while, but my mom comes into the world and she's taking care of my mother. And then increasingly, tensions were getting higher, obviously, in Europe. She's born in 39, and then it's mid-1940s to early 1940s. And, you know, there's clamoring that the Nazis are coming. Well, what was interesting about that, which my mother obviously inherited from my grandfather, was this just bulletproof optimism. He could not be deterred. He didn't think that
it was anything, fatal for him.
Fatal. And yeah, and feel free to cut me off. You know, I'm going to tell you the story, but if you want to jump in, please.
Yeah, I didn't know you were going to make that comment. That was one of the things that jumped out at me. It's like that optimism, I made that connection to your mom. And
yeah, well, I can tell you, it's interesting too. Just, you know, I think all stories ultimately, not to sound, I guess, egotistical, but, you know, you typically when you are reading a piece of history or talking to a family member, you tie it back into yourself, right? How does this impact me? I would say I'm like a closet optimist. So, just the way I've always been, like I sort of portray myself more pessimistically. Again, these are all things I'm still trying to figure out. And this is probably the biggest takeaway from the book is that, you know, this impacted me a lot more than I ever realized, this whole story. And again, we can get back into that stuff. But just kind of rounding out the story holistically, and then we can break it down piecemeal. My grandfather did not think the Nazis would come. Fast forward to a day when the Nazis knock on my mom's front door. My grandmother had sort of prepared for this. She'd gotten false documentation. She had cut a hole in the back of the house through a fence. She literally grabs my mother. They just run. My grandmother knew of what they term a righteous Gentile, a non-Jewish doctor in town. It was a small, you know, just think, I know you're in the Boston area. I grew up in the Jersey area, kind of a small suburban area. And by the way, at the end of the book, we go back and visit with my children. So that's pretty impactful. And she grabs my mother, my grandmother does, as the Nazis are grabbing my grandfather. And they just run through this hole in the fence. And they go and they meet with Dr. Ivo Scherzer is his name. And he has a contact at a Catholic school for boys in town, and knew the nun, a woman named Matilda Gorichonich. These are names that I did not know prior to writing this book. I'd heard of them in the past. They never stuck with me to the point where I would be able to recite them like I just did. And my mother is then hidden inside this Catholic school for boys. Now, it's one of, they're different over the years, stories. It's almost like that game Telephone. Like one person starts with one phrase and then you get through the 10 people and it's a totally different thing. So I'd heard stories that I remembered through my realms of memory, if I can use your title, that she was hidden as a boy. In other words, they cut her hair off. When we sat down to do this book, she told me that was nonsense and she likes to yell at me. So she's like, no.
Because you're probably thinking about Holocaust films and things that you've seen. Yeah. Right? You're filtering it through all that stuff.
Well, I'm an emotional guy. And I remember seeing the movie Life is Beautiful, and not to say that I cry at movies, but there was something about that movie, like the little actor almost looks like my mom in that movie. And after that movie, I was just sitting there sobbing, literally, like just for like 20 minutes in the seat. So maybe that's how I pictured her. But she reassured me she was openly a young girl. She didn't have to hide, but she did learn, like, you know, she was taught her Hail Marys or Catholic prayers. And this nun hit her. And she tells a story in the book that when she's dropped off there by my grandmother, her mother, she says a mother never leaves her child alone. My mom has always been like an old soul. She always describes herself as precocious. So she's 4.5 years old at this time and is basically yelling at her mother, how dare you leave me here? But obviously my grandmother was doing what she needed to do to keep her safe. And then ultimately they reunite once things settle down and my grandmother takes her to Budapest. And then there's the historic siege on Budapest where the Russians come storming in and they liberate my, help liberate some of the Jews, including my mother and my grandmother. And that's ultimately how they are saved, reunited, and then go back home to get eyewitness accounts of what happened. And my grandfather sadly was gassed in Auschwitz. And it was his optimism. My mom tells a story that really did him in. When he arrived at Auschwitz, he had gone, as I said, to school for optometry in Germany. He spoke fluent German without an accent, you know, in German. And he went up to one of the Nazis running, that part of the camp and said, look, I've got this degree. I speak German. And the guy, I guess, was having a bad day and said, go over there. And his father-in-law followed him. And there was a line to the gas chamber and people, you know, eyewitnesses had seen that. And that was his demise, sadly.
He just couldn't believe it because he had so much exposure to that culture. He was in disbelief to the very end.
100%.
Which is a theme. That's a common theme.
100%.
So you mentioned that some of this, you're discovering a lot of this story as you work on the book. And you mentioned throughout the book how much you're discovering, how much you didn't know. Can you give a sense of that? I think probably the best example is this frame picture of this nun that's in your house. You're growing up with this picture of this woman, and how much did you know about who this person even was, what her significance was?
Yeah, basically nothing. So, I thought, again, the way you're raised is essentially your barometer for what is normal. Just to go back to my mom for a second, at one point, this is a long digression. I'm not going to go into it completely, but in 1999, I had some odd jobs along the way in broadcast, and one of them was working for the documentary filmmaker Michael Moore, the big guy with the hat. And after I was done working for him for a summer, he was doing a live show at the time. I think it was 1999. He was doing a live show broadcast in the UK, and he was, as part of it, full-on nudity was allowed, and he was reenacting the big news events of that summer with completely naked actors. That was the summer that Stephen King was hit by a van, and I had to go around New York and find a Stephen King lookalike who was willing to be completely naked in Central Park to reenact. So that's what I was dealing with Michael Moore. But after that summer of working,
That was an Australian news show. I visited a friend in Australia, and they had the naked news on TV. So I read that. I was like, what if they got that idea from Australian broadcaster?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. But long story short, Michael Moore basically knew about my mom a little bit and said to me, make sure you document this. So kind of a full circle thing here in terms of what I knew and what I didn't know. And I was saying that, you know, your childhood is kind of the barometer of normalcy. Well, I interviewed two of my mom's friends, Moore, but of these two, they were both in Poland, which was a lot more difficult and a lot harsher. And my mom's friends, one of them was literally hidden in a coffin, and the other was put into like a pig carcass at times to hide in there, like a hollowed out pig carcass or a hog, you know. And when I asked them, like, how were their childhoods? They were like, it was fantastic. It was wonderful. It was a great time, you know? Which brings me back to that movie, Life is Beautiful, where they're playing a game in the concentration camp. The father does that to kind of alleviate all the horrors. So, So my mom, and back to me and all this with the nun, I grew up in a household in suburban New Jersey, where it was kind of a microcosm of New York. It was, you know, like a quarter Jewish, quarter black kids, quarter, you know, non-Jewish white kid. I went to public school, the whole thing. And we had this picture of this nun, Matilda Gorochanich, in my living room. And I just thought, hey, every Jewish kid's got a picture of a nun in their living room. I never thought much of it. And because of my mom's nature, my mom is just not one. She does not dwell. She's constantly moving forward. She's super strong mentally. She's got the mind of like a steel trap. Nothing can really bring her down. And she just didn't share much. And I think she was just doing that very much like her mother did to her to protect her. She did not want, it was my sister and myself. I had another sibling who my mom lost. We can get into that. But she didn't want us dwelling in the past. That was her big thing. That's kind of a common refrain from her, is to move forward. Don't become a victim. So she was hyper vigilant, probably unhealthily aware of, you know, being described as a victim, never wanted that, and sort of just did everything she could to raise us in New Jersey as a normal American family. She always calls me a dumb American. So there you go.
So it's a couple things going on. Like, she doesn't want to burden her kids with this. And at the same time, she doesn't want to be seen. She doesn't want to be burdened by it herself. She doesn't want to be cast as a victim herself. In the course of your book, I mean, she herself is acknowledging that she kind of emotionally cut herself off, right, as a young person. But it seemed like that spreads to other parts of her life. Maybe it starts as a young kid with the Holocaust, but then it gets connected to other things. And I thought it was interesting because she becomes a young mother and she experiences like a second round of tragedy. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping you could tell the story. What happens, and how much of that past did you know about?
Yeah. Well, you know, again, writing the book was super cathartic. It was also, I think, for both of us, for her as well. I have to, you know, lay down the disclaimer that none of this is "quote unquote" normal. I think I've come to learn, though, in life that there's no such thing really as a normal family dynamic anywhere. But, you know, our relationship is, I kind of joke, you know, don't try this on TV. It's not something that maybe should be emulated by everyone. It's, you know, she and I definitely are very, very close, probably too close. And I think obviously the trauma that she endured and what I'm about to share also made the bond even stronger for her toward me and me toward her. But I didn't know him, but I had a brother. His name was Abraham, or the nickname for him was Rami. He was born with a genetic illness. And so this was back in, I think, 1967 that he's born. I'm born in 69. And I guess one of the symptoms of this genetic illness is that you actually appear very healthy and robust, but you're not. So he was a good looking baby and lived to about 4 or 5, I want to say. And he ultimately had to be put into a home. I never knew this part either. I had no idea. So my mom, as I was coming into the world, basically had to give him to caretakers at a home because he was just in such bad shape. And as I was essentially coming into the world, he was leaving the world. And that's literally more than I had ever known about him. I just really didn't know much about him. And again, this just goes back to my dad, obviously. Here, my dad's born in America, born in Brooklyn, raised in the Bronx. My dad was an era of the great product of the Great Depression. My dad was born in 1933. He sadly passed away a couple of years ago. And I was equally close with my dad, who was kind of the yin to my mom's yang, very soft-spoken, funny, dry sense of humor. He was a psychiatrist, so knew, you know, the side of people that are not always necessarily talked about. And both he and my mom made a conscious decision. And I think about this because I have three kids. I don't think I could have done this, which is to sort of suppress it, not dwell on it. Hey, we had a kid. This kid passed away. Now, through my career, you know, as a journalist, in particular, there was one story that I worked on extensively at Fox in New York, which was related to pediatric cancer. There was the Empire State Building, you know how it lights up at night. Well, they refused to light in gold in September for cancer. Turned out it was like some sort of financial agreement they had with some other organization, and people were really upset. And so, long story short, I got to meet, and New York City turned gold. We got Times Square to turn gold and other places, and the Empire State Building refused to do it. And they looked horrible, and in my opinion, are still horrible for not doing that. But I would meet these parents, and these parents, understandably, were just wrecked, devastated. And they would go to the cemeteries every day. They would wear pins and buttons of their children. Well, my mom and my dad, completely the opposite. I don't think they ever visited his grave. I never visited. I still know very little about him, relatively. Ironically, during the writing of the book, my dad gets ill and is passing away. So now I'm watching my mom survive in real time what she calls the hardest part of her life, because she was married to him for 63 years. She said there's no comparison with the loss of her son or the Holocaust as there was with the loss of my dad. So I'm watching her survive in real time. And there's a funeral at a random Jewish cemetery in northern New Jersey, which is where some Jewish people go to die, I guess. And I'm sitting there at my dad's funeral and literally feel something under my feet. And I look down, and 3 feet from my dad is this brother of mine's like headstone, but it's not a vertical headstone. It was horizontally sort of planted in the ground. I'd never seen it. It gave me obviously the chills. It was like, whoa, I really had a brother. But it kind of, look, I mean, there's no way to weigh this in terms of judgment or value. Some people are going to say, oh, your mother's insane. Like, how could she not mourn this child? Others are going to say that's her coping mechanism. Whatever it was, that's how she and my dad dealt with it, particularly my mom. But again, it just goes to this overarching theme in the book that she will not let herself be victimized or labeled. She just never wanted to be labeled. So she just wanted to live her life, be positive, have good things happen in spite of the bad in this life. And I personally think it's very inspirational. Others might a little maybe crazy. Others might think it's just crazy, but it's how she seemed to handle things. So, well,
the universal story is, how do people deal with tragedy? You know, does it sour them on life? Do they find a way to overcome it? My own grandmother survived the Armenian genocide as a child survivor, right? And her father died. So she was a very positive person. So whether it's something really tragic, or, you know, things happen in everyone's lives, and how do you internalize that? So,
yeah, I mean, you've got obviously the Armenian genocide. I was fortunate enough on my honeymoon, I went to Tanzania and Rwanda. You had the Rwandan genocide. We went to the museum while we were there, my wife and I, in Rwanda. You know, I guess, sadly, maybe there needs to be some life lessons about genocide, because it seems to happen all too often in this world. But just from a more micro standpoint, not macro, look, to me, my mom is sort of the pillar of strength, you know, in my world. And that's why I wanted to write the book too. I think, again, people can judge for the way you handle things, but as my dad would say, and I am working on a book called Surviving the Psychiatrist, because my dad was a psychiatrist, but my dad would always just have very common sort of themes. And he would say, look, the proof's in the pudding. My mom is successful in her own right with business and investing, and is great with people, and is, you know, she was a social worker by trade, but she's just, she's very inspirational. She's been through, you know, to hell and back multiple times, and nothing gets her down. Right now, she's actually in Israel. And I said, you sure you want to go? Because there's, you know, these ongoing attacks. And she just messaged me last night. She's like, I'm expecting the Houthis to fire missiles over it because something happened. And I'm like, you worried? And she's like, I don't care. I'll be fine. So it's just very much this mentality of you move forward, not backward. You don't dwell in the past.
So you've answered this question in part, but I'm plugging into your podcast, and I'm watching last Friday's episode, and it's on this gruesome murder of this, you know, victim that gets dismembered, and you know, you've got your guests on, and there's this homicide detective, and you put this question to him, you know, how do you go and witness this kind of crime scene, go home and sit around the table with your family, and you know, and he responds by saying, I put it in a box. And maybe at some time in the future, I can take it out. And I don't know. When he said that, I thought, I wonder if this is what, I mean, is this a fair way of looking at what your mom, I mean, she had some horrific stuff that she had to go through. And maybe she put that in her own box, and you're writing your book and you're recovering those memories. That maybe it's a safe time. Maybe there's enough distance. That's a big theme that runs throughout a lot of my episodes, is that sometimes you just need a passage of time, and you can deal with some of these things. So
yeah,
it goes beyond not wanting to be a victim, not wanting to burden your kids. Maybe you just need time.
Yeah. You know, well, they say time heals all wounds, right? So, I mean, there's an aspect to that, and it's interesting, you know, to your point, I wonder if, sort of subconsciously, I've always been very interested in true crime. Again, my dad was a psychiatrist, my mom's a social worker. There's a huge psychological aspect to these crimes. Why do people commit them? And then, you know, other issues like you just mentioned. So that detective is a pretty well-known homicide detective, a three-time Las Vegas Police Officer of the Year. His stories are unreal. He infiltrated the Cuban mob. I mean, straight out of Hollywood here, he was carrying $1 million in cash through a casino in Vegas to put a sting on the Cuban mob. And then he gets into homicide. And I have another homicide detective on, dubbed America's Most Respected Detective, a guy named Phil Waters, F-I-L. And these guys literally see the worst of the worst. I mean, we're talking dead babies. They respond to suicides, you name it, and the worst crimes, and they in a way remind me of my mom in a lot of ways, because they don't dwell, they don't feel sorry for themselves, they don't really discuss it to the point, to, at least with people like myself. You know, I think some of them, not these two guys, I don't think, but others are you know either going to therapist or speaking to people and or friends. But it is sort of fascinating. Phil Ramos, this detective in Vegas, just a wonderful human being who has seen things, like I said on the show, that he cannot unsee. And you heard him say he basically compartmentalizes. And I can see sort of people with a soft heart saying, well, how can you not talk about it?
I'm not enough to destroy you, basically. Yeah, you know, you got to have a lot of fortitude to be able to see that and contain it. And you know, he's protecting the people around him by not sharing those things.
Yeah. By the way, the tagline of my show, Surviving the Survivor, which is the same title as the book, but the show is Best Guests in True Crime. And I really do. I really have such a respect for these guys, especially after, you know, hearing them and seeing some of the work, talk about their work, but also seeing some of like the fruits of their labor in terms of catching some of these bad guys. But one of the things that is interesting right now, just talking about it out loud, you meet interesting bedfellows in true crime. And I became really good friends with Kerry Rawson, people will not know that name necessarily, but she is the daughter of the very infamous, perhaps most notorious serial killer of the 90s. And his crimes span the 70s through the 2000s. But he's BTK, which stands for Bind, Torture, Kill. His name is Dennis Rader. And she talks about basically his mind operated like this is a serial killer now, but his mind. And by the way, my book is got a lot of humor. I mean, people might get offended, but I say it's the first kind of laugh out loud Holocaust.
You're getting to my next question.
We'll get to but back to Dennis Rader, the so-called BTK killer. He's described as having kind of like a mind like a Rubik's Cube. So like 1 minute he's the animal control officer. 1 minute he's the president of his church, which he was. And then the next minute he can switch it the other way and he is literally binding, torturing, and killing women. So it's just wild in that regard, which is what fascinates me, how the human mind can work on different levels. Not to say that my mother is the BTK serial killer, but I have joked with her just saying, hey, you can literally turn emotions on and off like a spigot. I can't do that. I'm not like that. Like I wear my emotions on my sleeve. My mom's got a poker face. The BTK serial killer's got a poker face. And these detectives, one thing I learned about law enforcement that I find fascinating is they really remove the emotion. Like they are focused on the evidence and the case that is always pending or imminent in court. But I would be so emotionally dragged into these cases, and they just are able to investigate and sort of keep a wall around them, which is important from an investigative standpoint, because you don't want to let emotion drag you down kind of the wrong path. So I think there's a lot of interesting parallels. A lot of these are just coming up literally right now as you and I are talking.
It's just a day at the office for these guys. They'll go to these horrific crime scenes 100%. They know what to me, I kept thinking of professional athletes, you know, never too high, never too low. They have some horrible game and then they are able to bounce back. They don't get bogged down. That's a hard thing to do for anyone.
Yeah.
To my next question is, so on the one hand, I see you opening up that box that maybe your mom put a lot of these difficult memories, right, of her childhood, of your brother's death, and you're working through these difficult memories, unpacking that. But at the same time, reading your book, I'm realizing you can't put all that stuff in a box. I mean, it's come out along the way. And there are different points in time where you mention that, you know, and you're questioning yourself, you know, maybe you're discovering this as you're writing the book. It's like, is this where I get this from? And throughout your whole book, you're kind of making jokes about how your mom is always riding you about, you know, don't worry, this is not going to be the next Tolstoy novel, you know, just get it done. Right. But then you have a passage where you're revealing that this could be connected to her own family history, to her own dad, that her father had a chance to escape and he missed that opportunity. He basically stayed put, right? And she's somebody who wants to move forward. She's always somebody who needs to move, and she's pushing you, move forward. So it's not just you know, hey, don't get carried away with yourself. It's maybe that, and you kind of wonder yourself in that passage, is this a product of that particular past? And you even question, well, maybe, you know, you're kind of joking, my OCD tendencies is maybe my mom is always pushing with really high expectations. She has to keep moving forward.
Yeah, these are all amazing points. Look, there's no doubt, in most family dynamics have something going on. By the way, I tell people now, because I went through this experience, you know, your mom does not have to be a Holocaust survivor for you to look into your history. I mean, you're another person, obviously talked about your grandmother, the Armenian genocide, but even if your family has not been through a genocide, there's plenty of, you know, family stories. And
Trauma spans generations. Definitely, yeah. Spans generations, and you don't get a sense of that till you start to talk to your own parents. Right? Yeah. It's like, okay, where did they come from? What do they go through?
Yeah, 100%. And it's inescapable. It's interesting, just in talking this very moment, it's kind of like, you know, my mother and my father, and again, my dad passed, but they were on the same wavelength. You know, that they actually had a true love story, you know, that spanned well over six decades. My dad went to medical school in Geneva, Switzerland, because I joke he wasn't smart enough to get in here back then in the States. And so he met my mom there. But yeah, it's, you know, my mother, to your point, never wants to kind of be in state of homeostasis. Like, she doesn't want to just be still hanging out. She has to move forward because, again, like you just said, her own father was content and complacent, and that led to his death ultimately. And then again, like, I'm trying to like figure this out in my own world. You and I were talking off camera, if you will, for a few minutes, and you were saying, oh wow, your schedule is insane, because it was hard to schedule this. And like, I just got off of Court TV and I do a live show every day. But what's interesting is one of my inner monologues, not a dialogue, but inner conversation I have every day is like, I haven't done enough. I'm not working hard enough. And I don't want to turn this into a therapy session. I'm just giving you like some insight into
but that's a theme that runs through the books, and you're kind of echoing.
Yeah.
That's what I really liked about the book. It's really your authentic voice is there on every page.
That's one thing I don't hold back on, but I do feel like, you know, like an underachiever. I'm not living up to my potential, and I'm very hard on myself with that. But it's interesting because everyone I talk to is like, oh, this guy's always working on his show. And honestly, I don't know what that's a product of. I joke because I was in broadcast. I was, you know, basically a corporate slave to corporate media. And, you know, I was told, be here at this time, be there at that time, cover this story, have this for the five. I mean, news is a great training ground for, I guess, being abused. So I'm kind of used to it. But it's also this sort of coupled with my mother's expectations. Now, if my mom was here, she'd say, oh, Joel, you're full of blah, 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 blah. I'm so proud of you. You've done this, you've done that. But internally, it's a whole different story, which brings me to the point that there really is this generational trauma. But the minute I say those words, I can hear my mom and my dad saying, oh, Joe, blah, blah, bullshit, blah, blah, blah. Like, they never wanted, my mother now primarily wanted a label. So she would never want me to label myself as kind of having this generational trauma. But what I found in the book is, any which way you slice it, like, my mother is a paranoid person because of what happened to her, not in an unhealthy way, just in a cautious way. Not, you know, she's the life of the party. Everyone loves her, but can be non-trusting, to, you know, with some people in some situations. And, I guess the bottom line of what I'm trying to say here is, I realize how screwed up I am writing this book, but it's kind of part of my fabric. And so it is who I am, but it's interesting because it is all, a product of, I'm thinking of 10 million things while I'm talking. I'll give you one prime example now. So I live in Miami and I could hear my mother yelling at me. It's funny. I could hear that voice and she's still with us. So, on this planet, but yeah, I live in Miami, which is just kind of the epicenter of materialism, right? The Ferraris, the fast cars, the women with plastic surgery. I happen to live in an area, I am not one of them, of a lot of very high net worth individuals. So I've become like, weirdly, like I money was just never something I was interested in ever in my life, ever, ever, ever. I just wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to get to the national level. And now it's like I beat myself up because I see these people who are really successful financially. And I'm like, hey, why didn't I, you know, it's important. Like, you got to pay bills. I've got three kids. Why didn't I focus on that more? And so I'll go down these like rabbit holes. And these are things that literally my mother and father, and again, my mom, and maybe and my dad equally, were just and are, my mom, the type of person that would just never, she just knows who she is so well because of her experiences. Couldn't care less about, you know, materialistic goods. Lives in the same place I do. And while something like kind of impacts me, it doesn't impact her at all because of the things that she dealt with in her life. I don't know if I'm making any sense here, yeah, but I mean, I tend to fixate on some weird things.
What I took away from it, because you're constantly drawing this contrast, you know, that you had to have the fancy wedding, they had a modest wedding, you know, you had the expensive shoes and they really don't care about that stuff, that they were all about savings and you really weren't that focused on. So you're emphasizing this contrast between often your parents or your mother and yourself, but then that contrast is also connected to that the memories, the your parents' past, your mom's past in particular. It doesn't come out of nowhere. It's not like it's like self-created entirely by you.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I think about often, and I vocalize this with my mother, is that she is such, like, if you meet her, she is really kind of a magnet. People are drawn to her wherever. This has always been the case. Like, she was always my friend's favorite mom. She was, you know, now she lives in Miami Beach in kind of the typical, stereotypical condo where all the, you know, the old yentas come running to her. They're all, you know, my mom has always been the life of the party. But I guess one of the things that I deal with is she's such a powerful personality, such a overpowering personality that as a son, I think you're kind of like, whoa, how do I move forward on this path? Like without her, you know, we're not like, I have a 1.5-year-old pug. You know, he left the pug, Fred Brown. He left his mom when he was 8 weeks old and came to Miami from North Carolina. You know, I'm 55, going to be 56. And I've had my mom every step of the way. And she's a super powerful, sort of imposing figure in my life. Like, and then it's a very daunting thing to think, well, she's not going to be here forever. You know, can I navigate this world without this powerful figure? And these are things that I kind of dwell on now, like from an existential standpoint, and wonder, you know. And that takes me back to like the, you know, I don't want to sound vapid or materialistic, but I'm like, you know, how am I going to handle things financially? How am I? And I've been doing them all along. Like my mother would say, I'm full of you know what again. But these are things that are constantly sort of ruminating in my mind. And you know, I guess not to make the comparison, but, you know, it's like being born, you know, I'm watching the third season of White Lotus and Arnold Schwarzenegger's son is in it, right? So everyone is, he's always going to be compared to his father and or the Kennedys, not to, you know, create any sort of extreme parallel to the Schwarzeneggers and Carmela Waldman. But in my life, she's a very powerful, big, larger than life figure. So how do I kind of follow in her shadow, if you will? These are things that, you know, came out in the book, things that I wonder about, and obviously part of my own family history.
But I did, you mentioned there's a lot of humor in the book, because, you know, we're emphasizing these tragedies, but all of these tragic stories, they're counterbalanced by humor throughout the whole book. And there's a great passage that really jumps out at me where you're in the room with your dad and he's getting near the end and he can't communicate anymore and he's kind of staring off into space. And it's a really heavy, moving moment. But then you mix in this commentary about this, you know, radio station that's on and this, you know, that's, or I think maybe it's a cable TV show or something that's, it's targeting the older people in the Jewish community. And, it's got guests that are so old that they're already dead. Right. And that, and that one of these guests actually has hair that looks like you're poking fun at your mom this guy, Jackie Mason, on the show. She has the same hair color. So, you know, two sentences after you're describing your dad in that situation, you lighten the mood. And yet you do that with your podcast as well. I mean, I see, you know, you're dealing with this Dan Merkel murder and Donna Adelson's, you know, continuance. And you're introducing this lawyer guest and you're making a comment, a joke about his hair. He's got the best hair around. You're lightening the mood because this is heavy stuff to deal with.
Yeah.
So you do that throughout your book.
Yeah. I mean, I think I got that from my mother. And you know, I guess if I'm going to give myself credit for anything, I think my years as a journalist, one of my talents, maybe one of my few talents is being able to get people to talk and open up. And I can do, you know, I really enjoy talking to people. So I think that's where that sort of strength comes from. But my mom is one of the funniest people I know. And she says, I mean, she's always used humor. And my dad was equally funny, but they always use humor to get through situations. My dad had a really dry sense of humor where sometimes it was almost tough to pick up on it. But we also, you know, as a journalist, I consider myself sort of a professional observer, right? And my parents were both therapists. So the book actually sort of starts off with me in this nursing home where my dad is at the time. And these are the things that really, like, I don't know. I think when people write or retell stories, they try to frame it in a way that they think people would want to hear it. And it was very important for me to just be completely raw and honest and real. Like I did not want sort of an Instagramified book. I wanted it where everything is, rainbows and unicorns. I wanted this to be the real deal, like what it's really like. And, you know, I've always, this is just like a personal thing. Like I'm always wondering about who people are, what do they do, what motivates them. And so the book opens, I'm walking, you know, every day I'd go to visit my dad and there's this never ending hallway. It looks like it's out of The Shining or something. And on either side, there are these like portraits that line the hallway of people who lived in like, were in their prime in like 1951. And they all got these, you know, stereotypical Jewish names like, you know, High Goldstein or Solomon, whatever. And I'm walking down these hallways and I'm like, who the hell are these people? Like what kind of legacy? Like, why do they have these paintings? Does anyone remember them? And it's like, you know, I don't know. I don't know if it's a result of what my mom went through, but I'm always kind of wondering what is life? Like, what's the purpose of this world? Like, what are we supposed to accomplish? Am I supposed to be just a good dad? Am I supposed to make money? Am I supposed to be funny? I don't know. Like, it's like this weird journey that this book has taken me on in terms of the way I'm thinking now, even to you out loud. But it's like, again, just to bring us back to this epicenter where I'm at in Miami, it's like I see all these people who have all these things, literally material things. But I wonder, like, is it bringing any of them happiness? Like, is it? And I feel like there's a lot of vapidness, you know, like, and look, I in talking to you for just a short time that we're talking, like, you're a guy that's really interested, obviously, in people's stories. And there's all kinds of happiness in this world that can be derived from different things. But I guess, you know, on this journey, I'm wondering what are the important things to derive happiness from? And one of those that I've definitely found out is, and I was one of these guys, I got married late, had kids late, but, and in the book, by the way, you know, my mom, encourages everyone to not necessarily get married, but to have children. And having children definitely for me, was probably, you know, is the greatest thing I've ever done. I mean, and I feel like that's really given me a lot of purpose. So there's all this ancillary stuff that's
but even that is colored by the past. Even when you're talking about, you know, having the only son and how many grandchildren that your mom has, and that's a victory over the past. So there's memory of that carries over.
Well, I like to rub it in because my sister has five daughters. I had the only grandson. But yeah, I mean, a couple of things real quick just off the top of my head. So the book, which you probably haven't picked up on yet, but, you know, I went to Brandeis, which is not far from where you're at. And I know you went to school in New England, but Mitch Albom, about 10, maybe 12 years older than myself, I don't know. But, you know, to this day, he's got the best-selling memoir of all time, which is Tuesdays with Maury, which is about a professor at Brandeis. And that book really touched me. And there's a reason, I guess, it sold, 20-something million. Mitch Albom sold 40 million copies of his books, is that he's a great storyteller. And I had a point to make here, which I just stumbled upon. Oh, so I really wrote the book in that same vein. So that book kind of goes through different aspects of life, including death. And here, I just wanted to get my mom's take. So the book is like 20% her story, maybe 15%, and the rest is really just life advice from someone who's lived it. So we talk about finances, we talk about children, we talk about marriage, talk about technology and my mom's fear of it and her having like 200,000 unopened emails, which gives me anxiety. So it's more than just, which I think is important to point out, it's more than just the Holocaust. And Mitch Albom actually was kind enough to blurb the book for me, along with probably got the weirdest assortment of blurbs, because I've got, you know, Mitch Albom on the one hand, then I've got Dennis Murphy, who's a Dateline NBC correspondent. And I've got this guy, Avi Loeb, who's an astrophysicist at Harvard, who I met along the way. I have a stand-up comic. So it's definitely blurred by an interesting, diverse group of people. But the book is definitely, you know, kind of a look at different aspects of life, not just the genocidal aspects of life.
Sure. Yeah, sure. Again, I'm trying to focus on the memory theme, so I'm drawing that out. And just to continue with that a little bit, so the connection I made to what you're doing now and your book is that, you know, on the one hand, you're, you know, unpacking these memories from your mom's past and really airing these with a general public. And you're like, well, what are you doing on your podcast? The same thing. You're taking these difficult histories, these difficult paths, maybe that haven't been sufficiently addressed, and you're spending days on these things, and you're returning to them again and again as they come back into the news. I mean, doing things that you probably could never have done as a broadcast journalist, where you had your fixed segment, now it's almost like you have unlimited time that you can spend. As long as these things are still ongoing, you can make a choice how much time you want to devote to them. And it's a treatment, whether it's the Menendez brothers or some gruesome murder or the Dan Merkel story, it's a treatment of the past that's participatory. I mean, you've got this chat line open and your wife, the COE, is managing these messages that are coming through, but you're trying to open this up to the audience. It's not quite there. It's not a radio show where people can call in. That's hard to manage. Yeah. But still, people can express their opinion. You're open to the audience, or you're even asking the audience, what trial should I go to next? What thing do you think I should cover next?
Well, I thought,
to me, that's where memory is at right now. And when I look at the academic scholarship, it's all about how memory is now bottom up. It used to be top down, state orchestrating statues, and you watch from a distance. And now people want to be involved. They want it to be interactive. You go to the Holocaust Museum. You want to participate in this past. Everybody wants to tell their story. And there's a backlash to that. I mean, I know you don't get into politics, but there's a political backlash to that now, because a lot of those stories that are being told are people who haven't had a chance to tell their story. And, you know, and you look at the Menendez brothers, a story of sexual abuse that was mocked at the time, right?
Yeah.
And we see it in a different light. I don't know whether we've totally forgotten how it was understood back then. I mean, I looked up those Jay Leno and the late night hosts who may just totally poke fun at that. Now it's understood in a much more sympathetic way. We're in a totally different therapeutic culture where people feel like this is a healthy thing.
Yeah.
And there's much more of an understanding of those things. And I think the whole true crimes genre has opened that up too. And really, my understanding goes back to the Menendez brothers, the court TV opening up these cases to the general public. And then you have these infotainment shows that air. And then later on, you fast forward to these documentaries, TV series, and you get new evidence and just people who are more open and look at these things in a different way. And even the conversations that you're having, people are able to form their own opinion. And they're getting exposure to all kinds of things, sometimes really in the weeds. I mean, I cannot believe some of the things that I was writing down, some of the legal terms that you get into.
Yeah.
Well, you're really opening up memories of difficult histories to the general public. Totally opposite universe, I think, from what you came out of.
Yeah, I mean, and, you bring up some, I mean, really interesting points. First of all, you talk about the Menendez brothers, and that's like a full circle moment for them because they actually grew up in New Jersey before committing these crimes in Beverly Hills. And I knew them kind of peripherally in New Jersey because we played tennis at the same place together. But you get back to the realms of memory, you know, people are talking about the Menendez brothers today, but not really remembering, like you pointed out, the sort of the attitude towards sexual abuse in the late 80s and early 90s, which was basically to just, you know, tamp it down and compartmentalize it and put it away. That would never fly today. I mean, we see the Me Too movement, but I guess one of the a bigger point for me there is just what you touched upon, which is, and I take shots. I did not have the best experience at Fox News. I can say that sort of unequivocally. I mean, it was amazing for me to cover breaking news stories and go to Republican and Democratic national conventions. And I got to cover the Super Bowl and baseball World Series. And I did had opportunity you know, to be on the front lines of some of the biggest news stories. But I have no doubt, like the landscape is so different now. Like now you can really engage. I am really proud of what we built. You know, we have a community. We really only got into true crime in earnest maybe two and a half years ago. And we built up a subscribership on YouTube of over 138,000 people. We've had some months where we get between audio and we're found anywhere you listen to audio podcasts, but also between that and YouTube, we're getting like 3 million looks/views/downloads a month. And that's pretty substantial. I mean, that's more or in line with, you know, the way CNN's doing today. And I think the reason that the shift is happening is everyone was kind of put into these, executives were deciding who the on-air talent would be. Everything was 10, 15 second sound bites. You know, whenever I would do a story at Fox, an average story is a minute and 15 to a minute and 30 seconds. And as my career, I was later in my career, that time span was getting shorter and shorter, and the sound bites were told to cut down. But I mean, universally, when I had guests on, and I just had Robert Randon, who is sort of the preeminent. He's
amazing. That guy is gripping to listen to him.
Yeah, he's wild. He's covered the Menendez brothers story since the day after the shootings. That's how long he's covered the story, since 1989. But he, you know, he said to me something, and I hear this often. This is not a pat on my back, but just I think to the new landscape. He's like, I can talk on your show. He's like, whenever I do other shows, traditional media, it's like I get a soundbite. I can't get anything in. Two nights ago, we had a conversation with Robert Rand and a rapper. And this is why I love what I do.
Oh, he was excellent. I didn't listen to him. Yeah, he was outstanding.
Yeah. His name is Raided X, R-A-I-D-E-D. And his real name is Honoré Brown. But he was incarcerated with both Lyle and Eric for murder. He is a blood Crips gang member, but then when you meet him the way I did, he's just one of the more eloquent, smart, has this amazing, talk about realms of memory, man, the things that he brings in through his memory and how he's changed in his life, and he's basically advocating for he attributes the Menendez brothers to his turnaround in life and what they've done in prison in terms of rehabilitation. Look, it's a very divisive and polarizing topic. There's people probably yelling right now, leave those guys in prison, they murdered their parents. And look, I understand that argument, but it is amazing to hear perspectives. And we had this guy Rated X on. I had no idea who he was. Guy's got like 500,000 Instagram followers. He's a pretty established hip hop star. And I had a lot of people write to me saying, hey, I wanted the Menendez brothers to never get out, but I just saw this interview and now I'm pushing for them. I'm going to write a letter to the governor. I think they should get out based on what I just heard. So you can affect change. I'm not saying that I'm personally doing this, but
well, you look at the district attorney, right? In that case, he's somebody whose eyes are opened by a true crimes documentary, right? That was part of it.
Yeah. I mean, so yeah, there are a lot of really interesting parallels, I think, between what, you know, your grandmother went through, my mother, and the whole true crime genre. But it's you know, this world is just like, I love your title, like Realms of Memory, because I feel like I'm walking down like...
you can see the books behind me here.
Yeah.
It's a famous French historian who looked at these sites of memory in French. It's called Les Lieux de Mémoire, Pierre Nora. And he's one of the guys who launched the field of memory studies back in the 1980s, looking at how...
Yeah. I feel like I'm kind of walking down that hallway at Miami Jewish that I was describing earlier with all the portraits, but now I'm like seeing all these different memories from my life and other people's lives. But you walk down and things change and people evolve. And it's like, you know, one of the things that I think about all the time now that I never thought about, I mean, ever, you know, it was almost like, wow, I had this epiphany that I'm actually not going to be alive forever, that there is a thing called mortality. Like, to me, that is scary as hell. Like, and it can end anytime, you know, like it's, you know, you always hear people say, well, you know, every day is a gift. And I'm like, it's cliche, whatever. But you really don't know when your time is coming to an end. And it's scary as hell. You know, like my dad was a product of the Great Depression. Again, he grew up born in Brooklyn, raised in the Bronx. Literally, you know, the pictures that you've seen in history books of them selling apples for a nickel on the street corner, that sort of mentality. And my dad openly became a doctor because he wanted a steady income. He wanted to make a living. He didn't want to go through my grandfather went through, which is not being able to afford rent and stuff. So it's like these points in history, I think, are what drives and motivates you. But my dad, who was just fixated on money, and making money and financial gain, you know, the last 10 years of his life was like, I don't give a crap about money. I care about time. That's the most important commodity. And it was interesting because he really was sort of obsessed. Again, my dad couldn't, I don't think a guy ever bought a suit in his life, you know, drove the same car for 15 years. He just, because he grew up bereft.
That was security. Him and his family.
100%. That's all it was for him. But then to hear him say, yeah, I'm not worried about money, I'm worried about time, you see how perspective changes. But that is the ultimate, I don't know, the ultimate conundrum in life. Like, what is time? How much time do you have? You know, like it's a weird, I don't know, not a science, but it's just a conundrum, I guess, this whole notion.
You're, you know, I was interested because to get your take on the media landscape, because you're coming out of the traditional mainstream media and now you're in the universe of the new media, and you're commenting on how you can give so much more expanded treatment of topics and you have the opportunity to engage people, maybe to change thinking. And yet so much of what we hear tends to be the negative, tends to be people are in their own information silos. They don't talk to each other. I mean, I have colleagues who are just plugged into certain networks all day long. And I'm jokingly, you know, I'll make a joke like, you know, what's the latest on Radio Berlin? Getting totally different. And I almost want to listen in and say, okay, how do they cover the events of the day? Because what I'm hearing is totally different than probably what this person's hearing. Maybe where you're operating from, it's a middle ground, and you're trying to stay neutral, trying to keep politics out, even though I don't know how you do that, because look at the Florida State murder, right? When the perpetrator has political motives, how do you keep it out?
Right. The Florida State University shooting that just happened. But even in your neck of the woods right now, there's this, massive trial going on in terms of public interest with Karen Reed, who's accused of killing this Boston police officer boyfriend of hers. And I covered the first trial, but I'm purposely keeping Surviving the Survivor a Karen Reed free zone, because it's just become red versus blue.
Interesting. Yeah. So that's just intentional.
It's just like completely polarized. Like either you think that there's this conspiracy theory that these Boston cops, without getting into the weeds of the story, but basically this officer was out with his girlfriend, Karen Reed, and they were with a bunch of other police officers. And there's this infamous blogger who got attached to this story and basically alongside
Turtle Boy.
Yeah. So Turtle Boy, and turns out Karen Reed and Turtle Boy and even the defense, I guess, were in contact frequently. And there was this narrative built that there was this conspiracy that they killed this, that these other law enforcement officers killed this police officer. There's a thing called Occam's Razor, which is basically the simplest path is almost always the path that was taken. So here, she was angry. She was drunk. Most people, I think, some people believe that she backed up and hit him. That's what the evidence leads to. They've got the car data analysis. We're now in a retrial. But you look at this and it's like there's just a flock of sheep that follow Turtle Boy. I mean, literally, just like a flock of sheep. I don't know how else to describe them. That there's no self-think out there anymore.
Oh, he's got his own media following. I've got a colleague who's explaining that to me, how he can bring his followers, he can gather them around the courthouse, put pressure on witnesses.
Yeah. Well, he's literally in the news right now because of some more. He's facing some serious problems because he's definitely delved into the world of witness intimidation. But I mean, just to the bigger point is that everything is just so polarized now. But you couple that with traditional media, all of those outlets, I don't need to tell you, Fox is right, MSNBC is left, CNN is more left than right. Everyone for the ad dollar had to figure out a way, and it became this tribal politics that they created on these cable news. I mean, that's how these platforms are. The media in general always, I think, leaned left. And then you had Roger Ailes, who kind of came along with this novel idea of let's start this right wing station. And then things just kind of spiraled out of control. And then you got social media and Twitter and things like this, which has just become an absolute cesspool. But to the new media, the stuff that, I'm doing and others are doing, you're doing it. Look, we're having like a real thoughtful conversation here. And I think I heard Joe Rogan say this once, and I've repeated it a bunch of times. I'm not a big Rogan fan. And I think he's getting really stale at this point. But he did say something interesting. He said we live in a, like what people think is a TikTok and an Instagram generation where everything is instant, like instant gratification. But then he said people will listen to my podcast for 3 hours, right? And it's true. Like when I do a show, and my shows are about an hour and a half usually, people will always say, hey, can you go a little bit longer? And what's so different about this from traditional media is that there is this community. There's this, and the title of our show is, I made it up out of, thin blue air, Surviving the Survivor, which was a play on words about trying to survive my mom, but it kind of fit. This was pre-true crime, but just the word surviving the survivor kind of makes sense in a weird way in true crime, so I kept it. But there's all this feedback that you get. You literally have a community that's 138,000 people strong. I tell everybody, I worked in TV news for 27 years. I got probably 10 emails sent to me. 9 of them were like, I hate your tie. And now today it's like, I will literally get like, you brought it up. I'm looking for a trial to cover right now, 'cause I want to like balance out the Karen Reed mania. And so I was asking people for suggestions, and I'll get like 50 or 100 emails in a night. And this is every, you know, every day. And I get people tweeting at me and on Instagram. It's such a more intimate, personal relationship. The important thing here, though, I think, to point out is people are going to have to be very smart, in who they decide kind of going down the road on this new path with new media. People are going to be able to choose, obviously. It's kind of democratized media, right? So everyone can kind of have their own platform. But you, the individual, not me, but you, and not you, Rick, but you, the collective you, needs to figure out, well, who am I going to follow? Who am I going to listen to? Who do I trust? And you've got to know that you're getting an opinion. You know, on Surviving the Survivor, we try to, you know, give both sides of a lot of stories, but things get emotional. You start to advocate for people. I personally think the Menendez brothers should be free after all this time. I personally believe in these abuse allegations, because I knew people close to them. But there's a lot of people out there who say the complete opposite, and they might be listening to a person whose take on it is never let them out, lock them up. So I don't know. You have to figure out who you want to listen to, but I think it's important. Like you said, you'll tune into, you know, other stations to see the other perspectives. I think you still have to do that. You've got to like see all the sides to an argument and then ultimately come to your own conclusion.
But you shouldn't dismiss the general public as just lemmings following one media source or another. The people that have a thirst for information, and they are plugging in. Some of these episodes that you've had, I'm looking at the title, I'm thinking, how is he going to pull this off? He's going to devote an hour plus to a continuance. How is he going to do that? And then, but then you're digging up new evidence, and you're getting into the intricacies of the laws and explaining, you know, here's how wiretapping works. Here's how, you know, how you could have a, you could present evidence in a case and then not be held liable for that later on if it's under certain conditions. So people clearly have a thirst for that, and they're hanging in there even through these airings of these hearings that stretch out for hours.
Yeah. I mean, the beautiful thing about the world today, I mean, you just talked about true crime, but it literally could be like crocheting. If that's what I tell everyone, because people come up to me now and they're like, well, how did you start this podcast? And I remember, you know, this happened to be in news. Oh, you'll never be a correspondent. You're not this, you're not that, whatever. And I remember having a conversation with people like 3 years ago, and I was like, oh, I'm going to start a podcast. They're like, oh, you can't. It's too late. You can't do it. It's too late. You're not going to be able to get a following. There's too many podcasts. I didn't listen to them, and I got a pretty big following, and I'm able to make a living off of it, and hopefully continuing to build up this, you know, this brand. We you know, as a side note, we launched a, you know, I saw this thirst for like sports talk radio and political talk radio. And so we launched a second channel called STS Talk, which is true crime talk, which is basically our experts who come on our show who are now hosting their own shows about niche topics. And what I was getting to a second ago is that, you know, this is a world now of niches and hyper niches. So, you know, if you're into the realms of memory, you know that Rick, there's going to be a Rick out there hosting a show on that. If you're into horse breeding, you're going to find a show on that. So it's like this amazing world of niches and hyper niches. So I tell everybody who's like, I'm thinking of starting a podcast, well, you just have to like niche it down. And I did it all by accident, because I basically jumped into a super popular space, which is true crime. But then kind of unbeknownst to me, had a niche within a niche, which is this live nightly talk show about these crimes. Now, there was a lot of like what they call law tubers out there who are just essentially lawyers who are sick of being lawyers, and they, you know, cover trials and talk about the cases in real time. But I think we do something differently. You know, we bring in different perspectives, we have different guests, and it's just a totally different world. But whatever your interests are, you can find it. Obviously,
yeah, the range of guests you have, I couldn't have been more impressed. I mean, you're getting people who are alternative alternate jurors, family members. So just lots of different perspectives.
Yeah, I don't want to blow smoke up my own behind, but we have Steve Cohen on our team, who is a friend of mine from Broadcast News. And we really do have, you know, we say we have the best guests in true crime, but I stand behind that. We really do. We bring on amazing guests, big name guests, you know, the top names in this genre come on the show, and they offer really amazing insight. So it's a really unique experience, and I'm always excited for you know, guys like you who are doing something in a kind of a different space, drawing in different people. I feel like the world in the last bunch of years, maybe 10, 15 years post 9/11, somehow we just devolved into this complete political tribalism. You know, I've never listened to it, but there's a podcast I hear ads for it all the time called Meet Me in the Middle, I think it is. And that's like a novel concept. Like, you know, most people agree on most things for the most part, but the divisions are what's highlighted, what are highlighted the most. And look, the media is to blame for a lot of this, I think, you know, because they took a very conscious, they made a very conscious decision to go with this whole tribal theme. But I think the vast majority of Americans, and I've heard other people say this, they want to be able to put food on their table. They want to have a home for their children. They want to be able to go to the T-ball games and do these things. And it's like this very vocal minority that's like, Republicans suck, Democrats suck, you know, this, that. So it's like, I don't know. Stay grounded. I have faith in humanity. I know my mother would have faith in humanity. We all have a lot more in common and a lot more desires in common for our families than we have division, I think.
I just have one final reaction I'm hoping to get from you. I say, on the one hand, we're in this context where, at least politically, there's a backlash. I think the whole surge of memory from the bottom up, and these people who haven't had a chance to tell their story, and that's been going on for a few decades. There's a political backlash to that on the right, in that there's a concern that we're getting too bogged down in tragedies and stories of victimization, and that we need to pull together. We need to emphasize what makes us feel better about ourselves. Focus on the gains, the achievements. Let's not stress all the setbacks, all the problems. But then I watch your show, and clearly there's a thirst for that. So I kind of wonder, when you look at what the Trump administration is doing now, it's like they want to build a Garden of Heroes for the 250th anniversary, 250 life-size statues to American heroes. They could be minorities, they could be women, but you're really emphasizing the accomplishments, the achievements, and he wants to basically take the Smithsonian Institution and do the same thing, make that to be a symbol of a place that really represents all the achievements. And this is a legitimate concern that how do you tie together the country? And and one way of looking at memory, and I don't know whether to go back to your mom, is like, well, you forget the things that could divide you. You forget the things that could hold you back. And that's, you know, nations have been understood that way, that, you know, remember the shared sacrifices, forget the things that divide you. And I don't know, I look at the whole true crime genre and I kind of wonder, and people's thirst for knowing more, and maybe the understanding that can come out of extended exposure to these kinds of cases, maybe it's more complicated than that. Maybe we need a Garden of Heroes, a Garden of Victims, of Villains.
Well, you know, I never heard of this theory that's being floated out to this guard, not theory, but this idea of the Garden of Heroes. That's new to me, but it's interesting. And yeah, I mean,
250 heroes for the 250th anniversary.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if they're going to be 250 Donald Trumps, like all clone.
because on the one hand, what you're doing is you're sharing the story of your mom's tragic past, right? And you're working through it. And the podcast is basically stories of people who've been victimized in these horrible crimes.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. I mean, I did very little intentionally with the book and in my life. I always say that everything kind of happened by accident, and I talk about this in the book too. Like, my sister became a doctor at the age of like 22, went to BU's 6-year med program, which is probably tougher to get into than Harvard or Yale. And she was, you know, had her life all organized. And I did not. And I talk about that, but the book, I purposely sort of start, I think the first word and the last word are death, but in the epilogue ends with the word life or living or going to live life. And I did that on purpose because we're in this like place where we are somewhere before we're born, and then we live this life, and then we ultimately die. But you've got to live in between. They say it's like that little dash between the years of your birth date and your death date that matter, that little dash in there. And I think ultimately the book, even though it touches on obviously a lot of tragedy, the theme and what you get out of it from my mom is that it is a beautiful life. It's a beautiful world. There's so much to live for despite the tragedy that everyone ultimately endures in this world. Hopefully those tragedies and devastations are limited. But yeah, to your point, I think about this a lot. I mean, good news tends to not sell nearly as well as bad news. I mean, bad news is what sells. I think people have to derive their happiness not from media or news, but like the little things in life that bring that joy, whatever it is, whatever that joy is, whether it's gardening, whether it's going to the gym, you know, whatever it is. I don't think that we're going to be able to change the paradigm of sort of bad news. You know, they say if it bleeds, it leads. I think that that's sort of ingrained on us and in us. But I think people by nature, at least I get this from my mom, I think people by nature are looking for the good in most things, you know, like even in the bad, they're trying to squeeze out the good. And that's what, at least in the true crime genre, you know, we advocate for a lot of the victims. I was just, when I first got into this, was really amazed at how many people have experienced crime firsthand or been victims of crime. And there's an astonishing statistic, like 40% of Americans have been incarcerated at one point, like some crazily high number. So this genre just happens to touch a lot of people, but at least the way we do it, like you said, like I don't know how I do it, but I try to keep it light. I think I somehow am able to pull it off. Obviously some topics are tougher than others to do that with, but we always inject levity, and it's really a place for people who have either equal interests in true crime or have been victimized in some way, for them to kind of come together in a safe place. So we try to keep it a very safe place. That's exactly why I'm not doing Karen Reed, because Karen Reed is the most, you know, that is the equivalent of Democrats versus Republicans. I mean, it's just a toxic cesspool. And I don't even care at this point who you think is responsible for that crime. It's just, it's become a place where if you want to go and be ridiculed, mocked, and I personally don't have a problem with that, but people in our community do. But if you're looking for that, then you're seeking out the Karen Reed trial, because that's what you're going to get. I mean, I don't know anyone that's covered that case without getting caught in the crossfire and being threatened and all these other things. So anyway, it's a long way of saying that trying to find good and even the bad, and this whole notion of changing the paradigm with like the news model to cover better things. I don't think that's ever gonna. I just don't think that's like gonna change much. But I think that we all individually have to find our own sort of happiness and contentment and whatever that is that, you know, brings it to us. So
Joel, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me. Very, very generous of you. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you, Rick. This was amazing. You did your homework inside and out. I'm impressed. I'm going to now listen to this podcast, put it on my playlist. So I appreciate you having me.
I've been talking with Joel Waldman about his book, Surviving the Survivor, a brutally honest conversation about life and death with my mom, a Holocaust survivor, therapist, and my podcast co-host, and about his hit true crime podcast, Surviving the Survivor, Best Guests in True Crime. If you've enjoyed this or other episodes of Realms of Memory, tell a friend or family member. The best endorsement is word of mouth. I'm Rick Dedarian. Thanks for listening.